This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we visit what its discoverer is calling the Quimper Lost Wilderness, a slice of ancient rain shadow forest that has somehow escaped the lumberjack's saws, despite its close proximity to civilization, until now. So join us now as we go inside the Compass. Forty-six-year-old Stephen Grace is a writer whose eclectic interests have led him to write books on such diverse topics as historical cartography, urban history, the sustainable food movement, and most recently, the natural history of Washington's intertidal zone. But when he's chilling out from a bout of research and writing, Grace likes to run, and it was that passion that led him to an astonishing discovery a few months ago when he was scoping out potential running routes through the woods near his new home in the Ocean Grove subdivision by the shores of Discovery Bay. Following an ill-defined game trail through tangled undergrowth, Grace suddenly saw the forest open up before him, the scrawny second-growth trees and thick salal replaced by shady expanses of mosses and ferns under the high canopy of towering old-growth conifers. He felt he had entered a secret lost world, a truly pristine, trackless wilderness that time and human development had somehow left behind. Grace began visiting what he came to call the Quimper Lost Wilderness every day, exploring its boundaries, nooks, and crannies. And as he fell in love with what he came to think of as his private sanctuary, he also came to wonder how it had survived the timber industry saws that have felled 99% of the old-growth forests on the peninsula, and how much longer it might survive. Much to his distress, Grace soon learned that the forest is state school trust land, managed by the Washington Department of Natural Resources to generate revenues for education, and that it is slated for clear-cutting within the next 1 to 5 years. Grace says he never pictured himself as an activist, but the threat to his precious sanctuary has made him one. For the past several months, he's been taking everyone he can think of who might be able to help him save the forest out to experience its grandeur. I had the good fortune of being one of those chosen, and so it was that one recent windy day I was standing at what I hesitate to call a trailhead at the site of Huntingford Street in the Ocean Grove neighborhood. We're standing here at the entry off the road of a, well, pretty sad-looking trail that I guess you made.
Hey, are you disparaging my trail? No, I agree, it is a sad-looking trail, kind of by design. And it's actually much more of a trail now. It actually looks like a trail. Originally, it was just a game path, and there was a lot of sort of hacking my way through the wilderness here. All this tangled second growth, which isn't my favorite thing. I'm wearing glasses right now. I have these clear glasses on. I scratched my cornea at one point as I was fighting my way through the bushes. And sometimes I'd misjudge and get a little off track and then sort of pop out somewhere else. I'd end up in one of my neighbor's yards and come out all battered and bloody from my battle with the wilderness fringe here, trying to get back into the forest. And they think, what on earth is this guy doing? But yeah, so this is relatively civilized, this trail now, believe it or not. We've kind of done some work to clean this up a little bit, move some things out of the way. So it's a little more user-friendly, but it's still pretty rugged. I mean, there's no, you won't see a trailhead kiosk here. You won't see a paved trail. Yeah, so as soon as I move to my new neighborhood, I always like to get the lay of the land. So I like to start exploring, and I need wild country. Every day I've got to have access to a little bit of wildness, a little backyard wilderness. I love to run trails, and I've been exploring and sort of developing some trail networks where I could run through forests and then get out to the shore. And this became part of the puzzle, this particular patch of forest, because I wanted to find a trail where I could avoid running on the road and get over to Cape George, go visit my friends over there. The forest didn't look particularly promising. It's kind of scraggly, crowded second growth. It didn't look particularly nice. And this was winter when I first started exploring, so it was very dark. And I'm not real fond of bushwhacking, but I thought I'd go back in there with my machete and maybe hack out some paths to find my way through. But I had this wonderful discovery. Once I got back in there, the forest changed dramatically. I got out of that second growth and wandered into an area of what seemed to be relatively pristine primordial forest, old growth forest. It reminded me very much of Old Fort Townsend State Park, where I've spent a lot of time. The trees were large, they were widely spaced. It had all the characteristics of an old growth forest. And that started becoming an end in itself. I started exploring that. And at first I thought, well, maybe it's just You know, like a few trees, like one small stand that somehow escaped the saw. Sometimes these things happen. But the more I explored, the more I found. And I realized it was relatively vast. It just went on and on. So I started calling it this lost wilderness. There are no official ways in. There are no trailheads. There are no trails. There are no old roads. There are no official pathways. It was just a network of game trails, game paths, basically. And some bushwhacking and perseverance. I just kept exploring it. And I just kept discovering the natural wonders of a relatively pristine, old-growth rain shadow forest, which is extraordinarily rare on the Quimper Peninsula.
Anymore,
yeah. So this is the last fragment of 1% of the lands on the Quimper Peninsula that wasn't altered during the logging and homesteading era. You know, basically, it's just kind of Old Fort Townsend State Park, a very, very small fragment of Quimper West, and a few private property patches that the public doesn't have access to. So this is extraordinarily rare habitat. And I thought I'd stumbled onto something interesting, something important, so I started talking with people about it. And at first I thought I had it all to myself. I did have it all to myself, which was pretty cool. I thought, wow, I have this incredible like backyard wilderness paradise, and it's all mine. I thought, this is great. Nobody knows about it. I have like what's a, you know, comparable to state park quality right here in my backyard.
It indeed belongs to the state, right?
It does belong to the state, but people just don't know about it. They weren't using it. And so that was pretty fun at first. But then I realized one day I was sitting there looking at those big, beautiful trees, which are among the largest and oldest trees on the Quimper Peninsula. And I was thinking, that's extraordinary habitat. It's beautiful. But I was thinking, you know what? Foresters are going to look at that and they're going to think, that's a lot of board feet of timber. That's a lot of timber revenue. So I called the Department of Natural Resources, which manages this unit, and asked them what their management plans were. And they said they were planning to harvest it. And they sent me a map of their proposed harvest area, and it matched almost precisely the contours or the boundaries of the old growth forest that I'd found. So at that point, I really shifted my perspective and shifted my emphasis from, instead of kind of keeping this quiet as my own private wilderness, I sort of picked up a megaphone and started telling everyone about it and tried to bring in as many relevant experts as possible to assess it and to make a case that it is indeed extraordinarily rare and valuable habitat that merits conservation instead of being harvested for timber. I've had the great good fortune to come back here with a tremendous array of wildlife biologists, botanists, conservationists, ecologists, geologists, you
and
name that, it.
And just, actually somebody who worked in timber harvesting for years.
Right? Yes, yeah, and that's been probably one of the most interesting pieces to this puzzle. So I got to know a former DNR forester, who spent his entire career at DNR organizing cuts, basically, and harvests. So I brought him back into this patch of woods, and we had an amazing time. We spent probably four to five hours just tromping around, looking at the terrain, looking at the trees, looking at the habitat. And he concluded that it has very high conservation value. He thought it was extraordinary and really merited being conserved. In its present state, this stands. There are other areas of this DNR property adjacent to the old growth stand that are working forests that have been harvested in the past. And so that forester doesn't have any problem with those areas being continued to be harvested as working forests, nor do I. I tend to agree with that. I'm making a very limited case here just for this one specific area, which is approximately 30 acres of a much larger parcel that's about 240 acres. So it's somewhere around maybe 10% of the overall management unit here. And I just would like to see that set aside as a sort of living museum, a living classroom, a living laboratory, a living library of information that's accrued in this old growth forest to be passed on to future generations instead of being
also
harvested.
As I understand it, is vital habitat because there are trees out there that look like they would be very suitable for nesting of marbled murrelets.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I first wandered in there, I had just taken, fortunately, just taken a course through Jefferson Land Trust, and in that course, that natural history course that they teach, Tidelands to Timberline, they use this acronym, OWLS, O-W-L-S. So the O stands for old trees, so, and then W stands for wood, woody debris on the grounds, L stands for layers, and S for snags. And all of those features provide tremendous wildlife habitat. So this stand has all those things in spades. It has those things in abundance. So there are old trees back here. There's that woody debris on the ground, those nurse logs, which provide tremendous habitat for things like salamanders live in the wood that's decaying. And then there's a whole ecosystem there. And then you get into the layers, the multi-layered canopy, which provides tremendous complexity, which lends itself to biological diversity. And the snags, so the standing dead trees, or what are often called habitat trees now, provide tremendous habitat for many different species, like bats roost in the loose bark, woodpeckers get insects out of the tree, bears den in the hollow center, small mammals may dig their lairs around the decaying roots, eagles perch in the top, and on and on. And to your point about marble murrelets, so a lot of these older trees have broad tree limbs, which are potential nesting platforms for the marble murrelet, a federally threatened seabird and listed as endangered in the state of Washington. So they need those old trees because they don't build a nest. They just lay one camouflaged egg on a limb, and they need a very broad limb of a very old tree. And those are becoming more and more rare as we transform the landscape and cut the older trees. So here we go. Should we venture into the wilderness, Steve?
All right. I'm ready.
So here's a beer bottle at the entrance. One of the things I like about back here is there's so little signs of human presence. I mean, it really feels like a wilderness. It's only 30 acres. But I leave this beer bottle right here at the entrance to kind of remind me how pristine it is back there, because we won't see any trash again for a very long time. We'd have to go all the way out toward Cape George Road, where people have dumped things alongside the road. But back in the heart of this Quimperlost wilderness, we'll find woods that are relatively pristine, both in terms of no human impact, also very few invasive species. So the Scotch broom that we see out here at the edge, that's going to disappear when we get back in there. So one of the local luminaries that I brought back here, Fred Weinman, who's the former president of the Native Plant Society for the state of Washington and very active locally in the Native Plant Society. One of his comments, he and his wife Ann Weinman, who are both great, great botanists, great naturalists, they were astounded, pleasantly surprised at the lack of invasive plants back here in the heart of the grove, how clean it is in terms of no invasive plants, just the native plants in the primordial forest doing what the forest does without human intervention.
So I noticed that we're sort of standing in a kind of transition zone here. I mean, ahead of us, the forest is much wider open and the trees are a lot larger. And I mean, this looks like maybe the edge of where...
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's a great observation. This is definitely the transition zone here. And as you noted, you can really see the difference here where the spacing between the trees opens up and the trees are much larger. We also start to see a very complex multi-layered canopy, and we're looking at an extraordinary amount of woody debris on the ground, those nurse logs we were talking about, and we're starting to see more snags or standing dead trees, habitat trees. Here's a really fun moss. I love this one. It has a great name. This is, can see how it has this kind of the spiky sort of appearance. It's called electrified cattail, the idea being that it sort of recalls a, like a cartoon cat that's had a jolt
it looks
of electricity.
Sort of like Bill the cat. Yeah.
Right.
There's actually quite a variety of mosses around here.
Yeah, there's some beautiful stair step moss, some Oregon beaked moss. So we've got soldier moss back here and on and on. Here's some frog's pelt lichen.
I notice also we're seeing more and more ferns as we get deeper in here.
Yeah, and just yesterday I was finding a lot of lady ferns. are growing their fronds right now. I found some spiny wood ferns. And the sword ferns here are really coming back in force. After the snowpocalypse, that incredible blizzard we had this winter, all these ferns, you can see how they were really smashed down under about 18 inches of wet, heavy snow. Originally, I was wading through here, this ferny landscape here, and the sword ferns were above my waist, up to my shoulders sometimes, and
I guess you probably had a hard time following your trail then.
I did, yeah. There was really no trail here each time. So each time I came in, it was sort of a new adventure.
Yeah, I see rough forms as though of the bodies of ancient trees lying on the forest here.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, yeah. And from that old life comes new. Yeah, lots of nurse logs here. So a lot of experts who've been back here looking at this forest and assessing it for its old growth characteristics and its habitat characteristics have really noted that amount of an extraordinary amount of woody debris on the ground, those nurse logs, in various states of decay. Some of them look very much like logs, like trees that have recently fallen down. Other ones, like this one we're looking at here, are almost completely soil at this part. It's almost hard to see how that's even was even a tree.
Like
you have to use a little bit of an imagination there.
A long lump in the ground here.
Yeah. Beautiful western red cedar here. Not the largest we'll see, but I love the character of this one. Apparently it's fallen down, so it was horizontal on the ground. The tree didn't give up. It simply went vertical. So now you can see these five trunks, sort of separate trunks, rising vertically toward the light. So very interesting story
there. All
coming
off the same base. Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah. I call that the candelabra tree. I think it's a beautiful, interesting structure. It definitely has a story. Some extraordinary denning habitats. I brought Daryl and Lorna Smith from Western Wildlife Outreach out here. They are experts in predators, large predators like mountain lions, bears, and wolves. But have great expertise in everything related to natural history. So we looked at, they assessed kind of the denning habitat here and some of the different wildlife habitat potential. But here's an example. There's lots of great denning habitat, potentially for large mammals. There are bears out here in this area.
Does that cavity go deep underground?
It does. Yeah, I have stuck my head back in there for better or worse. I'm still here. I'm here to tell the tale. So apparently there was no bear denning in there, or maybe it had a back door and escaped. There another interesting wildlife issue is, so fishers, which is an animal I wasn't very familiar with until I moved here, but basically a large weasel, the largest member of the weasel family, they were hunted nearly to extinction, kind of at about the same time
that... Very rare now, I understand.
Very rare, yeah. So about the same time that sea otters were being hunted for their pelts, fishers that are kind of lesser known, they... unfortunately endured the same fate where they were almost completely extirpated. Now they're being reintroduced in some areas, and a pair was reintroduced not far from here. So some people have noted there is potential fisher denning habitat back here in this forest. So that's interesting to consider. We've talked about putting maybe a wildlife, a motion sensitive camera back here and trying to capture what's actually back here. I had fun during this big snow events. The tracking became interesting and fairly easy, and followed bobcat tracks, which was pretty fun. There's a bobcat that keeps appearing in local neighborhoods and seems to spend a lot of time back here. And then, in terms of other wildlife habitats, one of the other really exciting features about this forest is it's adjacent to a wetland that has a blue heron rookery. And those are fairly rare. I mean, blue herons are pretty common birds. I'm sure everyone's seen them and heard them croaking like dinosaurs, like pterodactyls. But finding their rookeries is fairly unusual. So that's caught a lot of people's attention. I found 15 nests, and my high count of birds back in that wetland was 12 at one point. I was sort of crawling around back in there, back in the sort of deep, inaccessible heart of the wetlands, and stirred up a bunch of herons. And it felt like Jurassic Park back there. I was on my hands and knees in the muck, and the herons were croaking and flapping, and it was pretty cool.
How old are the oldest trees in here? I mean, do we have any idea?
Yeah, nobody knows. No one's cored them. So we can look at some of these Douglas firs, and based on the bark, you know, people kind of look at the bark. It's really hard to tell by diameter because this is a rain shadow forest. So there's a very small amount of rain here relative to a rainforest. So the trees look fairly diminutive in comparison to something you might see like in the Hoh rainforest. They grow very slowly. Their growth rings each year are very, very small. But some of these trees are most likely several hundred years old, is what experts who've looked at them have concluded, probably at least 300 years old, probably more. The official origin date of the stand in the Department of Natural Resources database is 1885. So that means there was some human activity back here in 1885, probably some sort of selective logging back in the days of horses and mules dragging out a few choice pieces of lumber. They had to drag them all the way out to the water and slide them down the banks and take them out by boat. So much different than today's mechanized feller buncher cutting. So that wasn't a clear cut. Some of the...
Have you actually found some old stumps back there from that?
There are a few. And what's interesting is the very few stumps that you find are much smaller diameter than the living trees. So it was just a few smaller trees that were taken out. Very rarely do you see a large diameter stump here. Over towards Cape George Road, there are a few of them. But back here in the heart of the grove, there was very little human disturbance. And so, you know, scientists who've looked at this have concluded that the human intervention back here was so minimal that it didn't reset forest succession, meaning that the forest continued to do what the forest would naturally do, even though a few of the smaller trees were taken out. So it's essentially operating as an old-growth forest, was the conclusion of Fred Weinman and other experts who've looked at it. Let's see,
as we look at some of the bark on some of these trees, we see like really deep furrows.
Yeah, so we're looking for that really deeply furrowed bark on the Douglas firs that goes high up on the trees and on the really older ones. And the bark has a very shaggy, loose feel, and it's very corky, very hollow inside. It's like cork. And that just indicates exceptional age. I mean, these are very, very old trees. So what does that mean? That means that this tree was alive when Captain Vancouver was here in 1792, right? And he was just right over there in Discovery Bay, very close to where we are now. He spent a couple weeks there. He loved Discovery Bay. His chief naturalist, Menzies, who was his botanist and surgeon and naturalist, was botanizing in this area, exploring this area for its plants. That was
He may have walked past this very tree
and stood where we stand now. And the Douglas fir is named after him, Douglasia menziesi.
So when is the cut planned?
So at this point, they don't have an official plan to harvest. Originally, they were saying 1 to 5 years they were planning to harvest this stand. Now they're saying it's probably going to be a year from June or July. The next stage in the process is they're going to send some of their scientists back here to assess the stand, do what's called a heritage tree assessment, to look at some of the older trees and see if those merit some kind of special protocol of not being cut. So things are sort of up in the air right now. We're sort of waiting to see what the results of that assessment are.
Boy, some of these trees are pretty enormous up here.
Yeah, aren't those beautiful? Yeah. I mean, those are titans. Those are old
How tall do you
trees.
Figure some of these?
So I've measured the diameter of these trees, and I can do that very precisely. That's pretty easy to quantify. You know, we get diameters of around 5 feet on some of the larger trees. But then when you go to the height, that gets a little trickier. So just kind of playing around with a theodolite, which is an instrument I'm not entirely comfortable with and familiar with. And I've had some other people kind of play around with that. But we were getting heights of about 130 to 150 feet, somewhere in there.
Is that what your forester thought? Did he have an opinion about?
He thought that was definitely in the range and in the ballpark. So that kind of gives us a starting point. And again, you know, if you're considering if you've spent time in a rainforest, if you've spent time in an Olympic National Park, that may sound not terribly impressive. But given the extreme conditions here, a lot of these trees are on the very edge of what they can survive because of the low moisture regime here. So these are kind of at the outer limits of what Douglas firs can survive and what Western red cedars can survive. They grow very slowly. Some of these are Methuselahs, you know, they've been here for hundreds of years. Yeah, and you can see some of those larger branches up near the top of the canopy there. So those are those marble murrelet nesting platforms we were talking about, where that rare and federally threatened seabird and statewide listed as endangered seabird can lay its egg on one of those wide nesting platforms.
Isn't it true, though, that the same values that make these trees useful for the marbled murrelet also give them tremendous commercial value? I mean, that same, like, you know, tight grain, old growth, clear wood. I mean, it's the most valuable kind of wood there is right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some merit to that point of view, and I'm certainly not blind to that. I use wood products. I mean, we all do. None of us are innocent. This is a relatively small stand. I mean, if this timber were to be cut, it would take, you know, probably 150 to 200 years to get a commensurate type of forest, this type of old forest. Do we really want to cut? We want to deconstruct a living museum for a very small amount of timber. I mean, we go through that timber pretty quickly, and there are many, many other places where we can cut, other areas that can be harvested, that are on, you know, rotational schedules that can produce a lot of timber. This is a relatively low productivity site too, because it's low moisture, also low nutrient content in the soil. So this isn't the optimal place to be harvesting timber. I mean, the way I look at it is, you know, the Sistine Chapel or any beautiful cathedral has a lot of bricks, and those bricks would make a lot of nice houses. We could do a lot of cool things with those bricks. I could make a great fence around my house with those bricks. No sensible person would deconstruct, tear down the Sistine Chapel to reuse the bricks in a new construction project. I mean, this is a living cathedral. Nature has spent millennia creating this cathedral. We have this last cathedral here, and I think its higher value, again, is in preserving it, celebrating it, and passing it on to the next generations. You know, another issue, and there's so many other, you know, we can kind of get into the dollars and cents of the economic value, the so-called ecosystem services that a forest provides. So we can kind of move away from that idea of a cathedral forest and its sort of aesthetic values and cultural and historical values, and talk about just kind of the dollar and cents. You know, what does this actually provide for us, a healthy old growth forest? So not only carbon sequestration, but it's also mitigating flood and drought. The trees are like giant water pumps and water towers. So in times of drought, they're holding water and slowly releasing it into the system. In times of flood, they're sucking that water up to prevent devastating droughts that can damage our property. They're purifying the water. These coastal forests release nutrients that go down to the shore. And those nutrients allow phytoplankton to bloom, which nourish the shellfish and that we like to eat, and keep the coastal system there healthy. They remove toxins from the air, and they produce oxygen. I think we're all in support of that. I'm pro-breathing. So a lot of these things that we just kind of take for granted. I mean, I'm being kind of facetious, but we sort of forget about these things. There are so many sort of tangible values that a forest provides, such fundamental things that it provides, that we tend to take them for granted until they're gone.
With writer and accidental land preservation activist Stephen Grace, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ Live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.